Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts. Here's Daniel's prompt.
Hi, Herman and Corin. Now and again, we shift our frame of reference and our viewpoint away from technology for a second to talk about the many other facets of life that are interesting. And one of the most interesting, I think, is the idea of social inequality and the gap between rich and poor. There is a perception, I think, that it's widening, that our societies have never been more unequal. And there's a perception as well that I think is a little bit harder to describe precisely with words, that our societies are kind of, there's a malaise, they're sick to some extent. There's something wrong with how everything has changed so rapidly in terms of the inaffordability of housing, careers going from being, I think, quite maybe static concepts, at least in the knowledge economy, through to everything being in flux. And we're seeing kind of a mirror image of that in the geopolitical nature of our world. One thing that I keep coming back to that I read that kind of, I think, comes closer to most explanations to kind of put its finger on the pulse is the end of the loss of era of civility in politics. And I think to an extent in the US, which sets the tone for the global political landscape, we've really seen that in the last few election campaigns, that the idea that political discourse and the public discourse is a place for, even if there's, you know, strident differences of opinion, at least respectable debate, has kind of quickly gone out the window. And we're seeing a dog-eat-dog world. Now, my question is, we have two different dynamics. We have rising income inequality, or potentially, and then we have political extremism. Income inequality, I think we have to mention the Gini coefficient as a measure of it. The OECD countries do a pretty good job at measuring that. But my question is this, if we try to, what do you think about the idea that there is a significant correlation between the health and the nature of our political systems and income inequality? Is there any data suggesting that specific forms of government or policies have actually made a measurable difference in reducing income inequality, and if so, what are those? And speaking of data and the Gini coefficient, let's just test that hypothesis first. Is it correct? The world is a big place, of course, but looking at maybe the OECD as a whole, that income inequality is on the rise. And what does the trend look like in the very recent horizon over the last few years? Is it truly worsening? Which countries have the highest levels of income inequality? Which the lowest? And to get back to the main question here, do you think that if we, instead of going after the classic targets of this, which is fiscal and economic policy, if we actually start looking at the political level, we can actually make meaningful differences to that? Thanks, Herman and Corin. Looking forward, as I always, always, always do, to hearing your responses.
Hey Herman, did you catch that audio message from Daniel this morning? He was sounding pretty reflective.
I did, Corn. Herman Poppleberry here, and I have to say, Daniel really hit on something that's been bubbling under the surface of our conversations for a while now, this idea of a societal malaise. It's not just a feeling, is it? It feels like we are living through a period where the social contract is being rewritten in real time, and not necessarily in a way that benefits everyone.
Exactly. It's that sense that things are just off. We talk about technology so much on this show, like last week when we were digging into AI memory and RAG in episode 251, but those technical shifts don't happen in a vacuum. They feed into this broader environment where people are struggling with housing, job security, and this feeling that the political system has become a coliseum rather than a town hall.
A coliseum is a perfect analogy. The loss of civility that Daniel mentioned is a huge part of this. when debate turns into a zero-sum game where the goal isn't to solve a problem but to destroy the opponent, the actual problems, like income inequality, just keep festering. And honestly, I've been looking at the data for 2025 and the start of 2026, and it's quite a picture.
Well, let's dive into that. Daniel asks specifically about the correlation between political health and income inequality. To me, it feels like a feedback loop. When inequality is high, people feel unheard. They get angry, politics gets more extreme, and then the extreme politics makes it impossible to pass the kind of nuanced policy needed to fix the inequality. Is there actual data to support that?
There absolutely is. There's a concept in political science called the Great Gatsby Curve, which was popularized by Alan Krueger. It basically shows that in countries with high income inequality, there's much lower social mobility. But if you look at the political side, researchers like Nolan McCarty have done extensive work showing a nearly perfect correlation between economic polarization and political polarization in the United States over the last century. As the gap between the rich and poor grows, the gap glows.
So, it's not just a coincidence. But why? Is it that the wealthy have more power to influence policy, or is it that the people at the bottom feel so left behind that they're more susceptible to populist or divisive rhetoric?
It's both, Korn. It's a dual-pronged effect. On one hand, you have what economists call regulatory capture or rent-seeking behavior. When a small group holds a massive share of the wealth, they can lobby for rules that protect that wealth, which often means blocking reforms that would help the middle class or the poor. On the other hand, when the average person sees their standard of living stagnate while they see mansions going up down the street, that creates a deep sense of injustice. That's the Atsmeknelt oder Bell.
And that leads us to the Gini coefficient. Daniel asked if inequality is actually on the rise across the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries. For those who might have forgotten the technical definition, the Gini coefficient is a measure from 0 to 1, where 0 is perfect equality and 1 is one person owning everything. Where are we sitting as of early 2026?
It's a mixed bag, but the overall trend over the last few decades has been an upward crawl in most developed nations. If you look at the latest reports from the OECD, the average Gini coefficient for disposable income across member countries is around 0.31 or 0.32. However, the United States is a significant outlier among wealthy nations, sitting closer to 0.40 or even 0.41.
That's a huge difference. What about the countries at the other end of the scale? I'm assuming the Nordic countries are still the ones to beat.
You nailed it. Countries like the Slovak Republic, Slovenia, and the Nordic countries like Iceland, Norway, and Denmark consistently had the lowest levels of inequality, often with Gini coefficients in the mid-0.2 range. What's interesting is that these countries haven't just stumbled into this. It's the result of very specific, deliberate political and social choices.
This brings us to Daniel's question about whether specific forms of government or policies make a measurable difference. Is it just about taxing the rich more, or is there something deeper in the structure of how these societies function?
It's definitely deeper than just the tax rate. While progressive taxation is a huge part of it, the Nordic model, for example, relies on what's called tripartite agreements. This is where the government, employers, and labor unions all sit down at the table together to negotiate wages and working conditions. It's built on a foundation of trust and mutual interest rather than the dog-eat-dog competition we see elsewhere.
That sounds like the opposite of the loss of civility Daniel mentioned. It's essentially baked in civility. But I wonder, how much of that is cultural versus structural? Could you take a system like that and drop it into a much more individualistic society like the US or the UK and expect it to work?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Many argue that those systems only work in smaller, more homogeneous populations with high levels of social trust. But I think that's a bit of an excuse. We've seen that when you implement policies that reduce precarity, like universal healthcare or subsidized childcare, social trust actually starts to increase. It's hard to be civil and trusting when you're one medical bill away from bankruptcy.
Right. The malaise is partly a survival response. If the environment feels hostile, you become more hostile to protect yourself. Before we go any further into the policy side and those 2026 trends, let's take a quick break for our sponsors.
Are you tired of your neighbors having better looking grass than you? Do you want to show them who is really in charge of the cul-de-sac? Introducing Green Envy Bio Sludge. Our patented formula doesn't just grow grass, it dominates it. Using a proprietary blend of synthetic hormones and industrial-grade nutrients, Green Envy turns your lawn into a lush, vibrant green carpet that is actually slightly warm to the touch. It's so effective, it might even grow through your driveway.
Thanks, Larry. I think I'll stick to my regular dirt, thanks. Although, Alpha Lawn does sound like something people might want in a dog-eat-dog world.
It really does. So, back to the serious stuff. Daniel mentioned geopolitical instability and housing affordability. As we've moved into 2026, have we seen any countries successfully tackling the housing crisis as a way to bridge the inequality gap? Because for most people, their house is their only real asset.
Housing is the front line of inequality right now. In many cities, we've seen a massive transfer of wealth from younger generations to older homeowners and institutional investors. However, some countries are trying bold things. Look at Vienna, which has a long history of social housing, or more recently, some of the reforms in New Zealand and parts of Canada where they've moved to drastically limit foreign investment and corporate ownership of single-family homes.
But does that actually move the Gini coefficient, or does it just make life slightly less miserable for the middle class?
It moves the needle on what we call wealth inequality, which is often much higher than income inequality. If you look at the Gini for wealth in many countries, it's often 0.7 or 0.8. By making housing an accessible asset again, you're essentially decentralizing wealth. But this requires the political courage to tell current homeowners that their house shouldn't be a speculative investment vehicle that grows at 10% a year. And that's where the civility breaks down.
Because you're asking one group to give something up for the collective good. That's a hard sell in a polarized environment. You mentioned 2025 and 2026 trends earlier. What has changed in the last couple of years? Have we seen the impact of the recent AI boom on these numbers yet?
We are just starting to see it, and it's a bit alarming. There was a hope that AI would democratize skills, but so far the data suggests it's mostly acting as a force multiplier for those who are already at the top of the knowledge economy. In episode 249, we talked about the future of native speech AI, and while that's amazing tech, the economic reality is that the gains are concentrating in a few massive tech hubs. This is widening the geographic inequality within countries, which feeds right back into that political mauhentlighet.
So we have these rural-urban divides that become political divides. It's like the map of the country is being torn apart by the economy. Daniel's final point was about focusing on the political level instead of just fiscal policy. He asked if we can make a more meaningful difference there. I think he's suggesting that maybe we need to fix the rules of the game before we can fix the score. What do you think, Herman?
I think he's spot on. If the political system is broken, you can't pass good fiscal policy. We need to look at things like campaign finance reform to reduce the influence of massive wealth, or electoral reforms like ranked choice voting, which can help dampen the extremes and encourage more civil, broad-based campaigning. When politicians have to appeal to a second or third choice, they tend to stop attacking their opponents quite so viciously.
That's a great point. It changes the incentives. If the incentive is to be a firebrand because that's what gets you clicks and donations, then you'll get firebrands. If the incentive is to be a consensus builder, you'll get more of those. It feels like we've optimized our political systems for conflict rather than resolution.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that this isn't just about the US. We're seeing similar tensions in the European Union, across South America, and even in parts of Asia. The malaise is global because the economic forces are global, but the solutions have to be local and political. We have to decide that a stable civil society is worth more than a few extra points of GDP growth for the top 1%.
It's a question of values. I think about our own neighborhood here in Jerusalem. It's a place with plenty of tension, obviously, but you also see these incredible moments of local civility and mutual aid. Maybe that's part of the answer too. rebuilding the social fabric from the bottom up while we wait for the top-down reforms.
I love that, Korn. It's that idea of micro-civility. If we can't fix the national discourse tomorrow, we can at least be decent to our neighbors today. It sounds simple, but it's actually quite radical in a world that's telling us to be constantly outraged.
It really is. I'm looking at some recent data from the World Values Survey, and it's interesting to see that in countries where people report high levels of neighborly trust, the political polarization tends to have less of a destabilizing effect. It's like a buffer.
That makes sense. It's much harder to demonize a group of people when you actually know them as individuals. But when our lives become more atomized and we spend all our time in digital echo chambers, that buffer disappears. Remember when we talked about digital fingerprinting in episode 250? Those same systems that track us for ads are also the ones that feed us the most polarizing content because it keeps us engaged.
It's all connected. The technology, the economy, and the way we treat each other. Daniel's prompt really pushed us to look at the whole picture today. It's not just about the numbers on a spreadsheet, it's about the air we're breathing as a society.
And the air is a bit thin right now, but looking at the countries that are doing it right, there is a roadmap, it involves strong labor protections, universal services that take the edge off life's uncertainties, and a political system that rewards cooperation over conflict. It's not impossible. It's just a choice.
A choice we have to make collectively. Well, I think we've given Daniel plenty to chew on. Before we wrap up, I want to remind everyone that if you're enjoying these deep dives, please take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really does help other people find the show and join the conversation.
It really does. And check out the website at myweirdprompts.com if you want to see the archives or send us your own prompt. We love hearing what's on your mind.
Absolutely. Thanks to Daniel for this one. It's been a heavy but necessary discussion.
Definitely. I feel like I need to go out and do something civil now. Maybe I'll finally bake those cookies for the neighbors.
Or at least stop yelling at the radio, Herman.
Baby steps, Korn. Baby steps.
This has been my Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
And I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Take care, everyone.
And remember, don't buy the bio sludge.
Definitely don't buy the sludge. Goodbye!
Goodbye.
So, Herman, just to bring it back to the Gini coefficient one more time before we go. If someone is looking at their own country's data, what should they be looking for beyond just the single number?
That's a great follow-up. You want to look at the difference between the Gini coefficient for market income and the Gini for disposable income. The market income is what people earn before taxes and transfers. The disposable income is what they have after. The gap between those two numbers tells you how much work the government is actually doing to redistribute wealth and provide a safety net. In some countries, the government reduces inequality by almost 40% through these mechanisms. In others, it's barely 10%. That's the real measure of profitability equal
care. That's a fascinating metric. It's like the effort score for a government.
Exactly. It shows where the priorities are. If the market is creating massive inequality and the government isn't doing anything to mitigate it, then the malaise is a feature of the system, not a bug.
A feature, not a bug. That's a sobering thought to end on. But it also means it can be reprogrammed.
Precisely. We're the coders in this scenario.
Let's hope we're good ones. All right, for real this time. Thanks for listening.
See you next week.
So, thinking about the future, Herman, as we head further into 2026 and 2027, do you see any emerging technologies that might actually help reduce inequality rather than exacerbate it? We're always so focused on the risks.
I do, actually. I'm closely following the development of decentralized finance and identity systems that aren't controlled by massive corporations. If we can create systems where people truly own their data and can monetize it directly, or where small-scale entrepreneurs can access capital without going through traditional, often biased banking systems, that could be a huge equalizer. We touched on this a bit in episode 248 when we talked about steganography and hidden data, but the broader application of secure, private, decentralized tools is very promising.
Like giving people the tools to build their own economic microclimates?
Exactly. It's about agency. A lot of the malaise comes from a feeling of powerlessness. If you feel like the global economy is just something that happens to you, you're going to be miserable. If you feel like you have the tools to navigate it and build something for yourself and your community, that changes the psychological dynamic entirely.
It moves from a passive malaise to an active engagement. That's a much more hopeful direction.
It is. But again, it requires the political and legal framework to allow those tools to flourish rather than being crushed by incumbents. It always comes back to the politics.
It really does. It's the foundation for everything else. Well, I think that's a perfect place to wrap it up.
Agreed.
This has been my weird prompts. We'll see you in the next one.
Bye, everyone.
One more thing, Herman. Did you see that report about the happiness gap in 2025? It was saying that even in wealthy countries, the gap in reported life satisfaction between the top and bottom income deciles is at its widest point in 40 years.
I did see that. It's what social scientists call relative deprivation. It's not just about how much you have in absolute terms. It's about how you perceive your standing relative to others. When the gap is huge, the people at the bottom feel a deep sense of shame and exclusion, which is incredibly corrosive to mental health and social cohesion. It's another layer of that malaise Danielle was talking about.
It's like we're all living in the same country, but in completely different emotional realities.
That's exactly it. And you can't have a healthy democracy when people aren't even living in the same version of reality, emotionally or factually.
Which brings us back to the need for that shared space, that civility.
Exactly. We have to find a way to bridge those realities.
Well, we're trying to do our small part here, I suppose.
One prompt at a time. Corn.
One prompt at a time. All right, thanks again, everyone.
Goodbye.
Hey, Herman. I just remembered something. Speaking of Daniel and his prompts, remember that one he sent a few months ago about the history of secret military networks? Episode 247?
Oh, the Shadow Webs episode. Yeah, that was fascinating. Why do you ask?
Well, I was thinking about the parallel between those hidden infrastructures and the hidden economic structures we're talking about today. There's so much of the global economy that happens in these shadow spaces offshore accounts, dark pools of capital, complex derivatives. It's another layer of that inequality that most people can't even see, let alone influence.
That's a brilliant connection. Just as there's a parallel internet that most of us never touch, there's a parallel economy for the ultra-wealthy that operates by completely different rules. It's the ultimate lack of transparency. If the average person knew just how much wealth was hidden in those shadow networks, the malaise would probably turn into an outright fever.
Which is why transparency and misconception busting, as we like to call it, is so important. People need to know the scale of what we're dealing with.
Absolutely. Knowledge is the first step toward reform. If you don't know the system is rigged, you just think you're failing. But when you see the structures, you realize it's a systemic issue.
And that's a much more productive way to look at it. It moves the blame from the individual to the architecture.
Precisely. And architectures can be redesigned.
Let's hope we're getting better at design then.
We're learning, Corn. We're learning.
All right. I think we've definitely covered it all now.
For now, at least. Until Daniel sends us another one that makes us question everything.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for listening to my weird prompts.
See you next time.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You know, Herman, before we truly finish, I was thinking about the malaise word again. It's such a specific term. It was famously used by President Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s to describe a similar period of stagnation and lack of confidence.
You're right. The crisis of confidence speech. It's interesting because he was criticized for being too honest about the national mood. People wanted optimism, not a lecture on their lack of purpose. But in hindsight, many historians see it as a very prescient diagnosis of the time.
It feels like we're in a similar moment now, but instead of oil shortages and inflation, we have housing shortages and AI-driven uncertainty. The underlying feeling that the future is less certain than the past is the same.
And just like in the 70s, the way out isn't just a new policy or a new technology. It's a fundamental shift in how we view our responsibilities to each other. Carter talked about the worship of self-indulgence and consumption. If we replace that with a focus on community and shared stability, that's how you break the malaise.
It's about moving from me to we.
Exactly, and that's the most difficult political project there is.
But also the most rewarding.
Without a doubt.
Okay, now I'm really done.
Me too.
Thanks again, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Wait, Korn, one last thing.
Oh boy, here we go.
No, it's just a funny thought. Do you think Larry's biosludge is a we or a me product?
Oh, it's definitely a me product. It's about having the best lawn at the expense of everyone else's soil health. It's the alpha lawn, remember?
You're right. It's the ultimate malaise product, a synthetic solution to a social competition.
Exactly. Don't be like the biosludge, folks. Be like the Nordic model.
Well said.
All right. For real. For real. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
See you in episode 253.
Can't wait.
Bye.
Bye.
So, Herman?
No, Korn, stop. We have to go.
Okay, okay, I'm stopping.
Good.
But you have to admit, the Gini coefficient for cookies in this house is currently very skewed towards you.
That is a fair point. I will redistribute the cookies immediately.
Tripartite agreement reached.
Exactly. See? It works.
All right, we're out. Bye.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.